Demigods to Myths and Muses. I'm your host, Cass, daughter of Cleo, the Muse of History, and this will be the next to last episode for the 2023 season. It's not so much that my mother has decided my penance for breaking the space-time continuum is over, so much as she decided it should take a different form for a few months. I'm being sent on a research expedition, and I'm only about 70% certain that it's within this plane of reality. It's often better just not to ask questions. But I've been assured that whatever realm I'm chucked into, she'll yank me out sometime in 2024, so Myths and Muses will be back for a second season next year. That makes this a great time to make sure you're subscribed to the podcast, so that you'll be certain to hear as soon as new episodes are coming out. In the meantime, however, we have a couple of great episodes to finish out this season. Today's topic is sports and athletics. When we think about sports and mythology, one event tends to stand above the rest, the Olympic Games. Held every 4 years in Olympia from 776 BCE until 373 CE, the ancient Olympic festival brought the city-states of Greece together in a pan-Hellenic truce, during which all feuds and wars were suspended. That's a run of 293 Olympics over more than a millennium. The games were held in honor of Zeus, and some accounts give Zeus the credit for their origin as a festival to celebrate his victory over Cronus, a victory he achieved by wrestling his father for the throne of Olympus. At those first games, it was said that Apollo outran Hermes and outboxed Ares. The historical Olympics might also have grown out of funeral games, which were common for important people both in the mortal world and in mythology, like those held for Patroclus after his death in the Trojan War, or those that the Trojan prince Aeneas threw on the anniversary of his father's death. As many as 40,000 athletes and spectators would travel to Olympia for the games. Greek culture valued athleticism and competitiveness, so it makes sense that each city-state would take this opportunity to show off their best citizens. Games began with a procession from the nearby city to the Olympic grounds. All athletes and officials swore oaths to abide by the rules and to compete and judge with honor. Winners received victory crowns of olive leaves and branches cut from a sacred tree, along with red woolen ribbons to wear. But Cass, I can hear some of you saying, I thought that victors got laurel wreaths in honor of Apollo. That was true in some places, especially at the Pythian Games, held near Apollo's oracle at Delphi. Laurel wreaths came to symbolize achievement not only in athletics, but in music, poetry, and theater. The Olympic wreaths, though made from olive trees, did still have a mythological origin, though. The trees were said to have been planted by Heracles. Heracles was a popular figure among Greek athletes. Some successful competitors would style themselves like him, wearing a lion-skin cloak or carrying a club. Demigods, do you think that these athletes were boasting of their own awesomeness, comparing themselves to Heracles? Or do you think maybe they were trying to call some of Heracles' power down into themselves so that they would perform better? The only event at the very first Olympics was a foot race. That grew to include wrestling and boxing, horse and chariot races, trumpeter competitions. Yes, trumpeter competitions. And the pentathlon, a five-sport event consisting of a short foot race, the javelin throw, discus throw, the long jump, and ending with wrestling. Oh, that's Aunt Cal, Aunt Calliope, muse of epic poetry, wanting me to talk about some epic moments related to that sport in particular. Wrestling, that is. It was hugely popular in the ancient world, and as anyone who's ever watched a WWE event can attest, it still enjoys a lot of popularity today. Wrestling was an important sport not only in the Olympics and other games, but in mythology as well. I already mentioned Zeus wrestling Cronus for control of Olympus, but there's also Heracles, who wrestled, well, a lot of his foes. Like the Nemean lion, whose fur had the magical quality of repelling arrows and blades. Heracles wrestled him to submission, then strangled him. Or Antaeus, a giant who was the son of Poseidon and Gaia. Antaeus drew strength from his mother, the Earth. So long as he was in contact with the Earth, he could not be defeated. He had a habit of challenging any passers-by to a wrestling match, but he didn't let anyone tap out. His matches only ended in death, and he built a temple out of the skulls of the defeated. Ugh, gross. Heracles managed to lift him off of the earth, however, and then squeezed his ribs, killing him. Wrestling isn't limited to Greek mythology either. It features in a major moment in the Epic of Gilgamesh, a story from ancient Sumeria and one of the world's oldest myths. Gilgamesh was a young king, strong and very proud of himself. To humble him, the gods sent a wild man named Enkidu to confront him. When they wrestled, they were both so powerful that they broke down walls. Translations of the poem are unclear about who won. In some versions, Gilgamesh throws Enkidu over his shoulder and triumphs, but in others, Gilgamesh takes a knee and surrenders. Either way, though, the competition actually turns out well. Gilgamesh and Enkidu become the best of friends and go on many adventures together. In the English epic of Beowulf, however, a wrestling match definitely does not end so happily. In this story, the great warrior Beowulf comes to the hall of the Danish king Hrothgar. Hrothgar has been plagued by a monster called Grendel, who keeps eating people in the middle of the night. Beowulf lies in wait, and when Grendel shows up, Beowulf attacks him without any weapons. They grapple and wrestle until finally, Beowulf rips Grendel's arm off. The monster slinks off to die, but then Beowulf has to deal with his vengeful mother. Oh, yes, Mom, that's a good point. It's not surprising that the sports that show up in a lot of myths are the sports that were most popular in the societies that told those stories. I mean, that's still true today. Think about how many movies there are about baseball and basketball, or how sports stars are their own kind of celebrities today. In the ancient world, a lot of those sports were pretty similar from place to place. Many of them require just the human body, you know, like foot racing or wrestling, or else very simple equipment, and often equipment that was similar to what got used in war. So that's why we see so much wrestling, so many foot races, so many gods of archery in particular, so many ball games. A few civilizations, though, had interesting quirks in their athletics. Outdoor sports, for example, looked a lot different in Scandinavia than they did in the Mediterranean. And their pantheon reflects that in Ullr, who was the Norse god of skiing. The Prose Edda, a source that gives us many of the Norse myths we know today, calls Ullr such a good archer and ski runner that no one can rival him, and recommends calling on him if you need help in a duel. There's also one very famous Greek myth that has a connection to a unique ancient sport. The tale of Theseus and the Minotaur may not seem obviously athletic, but it has connections to an activity in Minoan civilization. The sport of bull jumping is, like many things about the Minoans, shrouded in mystery. We don't know exactly what it was, but it appears on a ton of Minoan artwork. I'll put some examples in the show notes. From what that artwork shows, the youths of the city would run towards a bull, grab it by the horns, and use that leverage to propel themselves up and over the bull. Sort of like the vault in modern gymnastics, except the vault was a live bull, who probably wasn't too happy about being used as athletic equipment. Believe it or not, a similar sport exists in France and Spain today. Known in France as course landaise and in Spain as recortes, participants in modern bull leaping try not to touch the animal at all. They get awarded points for how well they dodge out of its way or flip themselves right over it. The animals in these sports are never harmed, although the same is not always true for the humans. We definitely don't recommend trying this one at home. Thinking about bull leaping might also make you think of the modern rodeo, which grew out of Mexican and Western American cowboy traditions. With events in roping, steer wrestling, barrel racing, and bull riding, it sure seems like humanity hasn't yet gotten tired of pitting ourselves against cows and bulls. Demigods, which do you think is scarier and harder? Riding a bull, like a cowboy, or trying to leap over it, like an ancient Minoan? Oh, speaking of modern takes on ancient sports, Aunt Terpsichore is reminding me that it's time for today's interview, which, in honor of today's theme, we're going to call TSPN. You know, like ESPN, but with a T. Anyway, today's interview is with Anna Willenbrock, a mythic and Camp Half-Blood Brooklyn camp counselor. Today we've got Anna Willenbrock with us. Anna, thank you so much for joining us. Tell us a little bit about yourself, your demigod identity, and the work you have done with our camps.
Yeah, hi. My name is Anna Willenbrock, obviously. And I have been working at Plato Learning for this last summer season, I suppose. I am a artist and an athlete. I work as a sword How do I put this? I work as a professional stunt performer for the New York Renaissance Fair, as well as an actor in other aspects. But yeah, I came to Plato Learning to work at the camps this summer. I discovered that my godly lineage can be traced all the way back to Gaia, because I did come from a very long line of giants, Alcyoneus specifically. So the tallest of the giants is actually like my great 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 grandfather or something like that. But you know, this summer I worked at Camp Mythic, and at that time I discovered that I have a more modern god in my parental pantheon, and I learned that I was actually the daughter of Waluigi. So you might affectionately know me in Plato Learning spaces or in Camp Half-Blood spaces as Wanna. So everyone gets one large wah from me. But
That's
yeah,
fair.
I was a counselor this summer at both Camp Mythic as well as Camp Half-Blood Brooklyn.
That's so great. I didn't realize you'd been at Mythic, which is our new overnight camp that just started this past summer. Listeners, in case you didn't know about that one, I got to visit for a couple of days and it was a really fantastic experience. I also did not know that you worked with the New York Renaissance Festival. You must know, listeners, you heard a few episodes ago, Lane talked to us about stage combat and things like that. So
Yeah, that is
fantastic.
our Queen Elizabeth. I adore her greatly.
Wonderful. So, listeners, we've got a through line for you here over a couple of episodes. But today, Anna,
Surprise.
yeah, you are here to talk to us specifically about your history as an athlete. You've done some track and field, as I heard. Tell us about that. What's that part of your life like?
Yeah, absolutely. I have been an athlete for pretty much as long as I can remember, and then even longer, actually. If it wasn't swim lessons, it was soccer. I tried tennis for a while. If it wasn't tennis, then it was softball, and then basketball, then lacrosse. And that's when I kind of finally found track and field, specifically shot put and discus. I think it's very funny. I had an injury in high school. I was playing on the lacrosse team there. I was on JV, and I had a bit of an injury. I hurt my Achilles tendon, and I was having a really hard time running. And so I had to make the executive decision to stop for a season. I was like, okay, so this obviously lacrosse running back and forth is not something that I'm capable of doing right now. And I had a family friend who was in charge of track and field at my school. I emphasize family friend because he did come up to me and tell me that he would break both of my legs if I did not try out
But
for
in a friendly way, in a
yeah, but in a family friendly kind of way. And while I can't like recommend that as a way of recruiting children to play for your sport, it did work, and I very quickly found a home that I loved. It gave me a space to be the best athletic version of myself and kind of play to all of my strengths, which was something that I didn't know how desperately I needed.
That's really cool. Can you sort of say more about that? What about these sports particularly, and what about what you were doing brought that out in you?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I guess the part that I glazed over. I think the part that I glazed over earlier in like my sports background is that I am a plus size athlete. So the crazy thing about being an athlete and or just being a person, honestly, is that if you have a body, people have to look at it at some point, unless you know you're on a podcast like I am now. And people will often make kind of like assumptions about what your body specifically is capable of based on the way that you look. So for me, it was always one of two things. I was very tall. I hit 6 foot, I think, by the time I was in 7th grade. So there was two options for me. It was, oh my God, you're so tall. Do you play basketball?
Oh no.
Or it was that I was a plus size or a fat human being, and therefore I must not be athletic at all. And like obviously these things are both true about me at the same time. I am very tall. And I am also fat, but I'm also incredibly athletic. And that didn't stop me from trying basketball, decided basketball wasn't for me, but then finding sports that were, you know, like shot put, and finding that there are Olympic level athletes that not only look like me, but are stronger than me, are on this next level of fitness that, you know, don't necessarily look like what comes up when you think of like a traditional mainstream athlete.
I think that's great. I think that's a great thing for all of our demigods to hear and to know that, yeah, your bodies are capable of doing awesome things, no matter what they look
Yeah,
like. No matter what they look
absolutely.
like, they can be
Yeah.
strong, they can be fast, they can be powerful.
Athleticism and being an athlete is for absolutely everyone. And if I can impart anything to the listeners today, it is that your body is capable of so much more than you know. And you just have to find a sport or an action, which for me was throwing things, right? That makes your heart sing. And maybe that's basketball for you, or maybe for me and Lane, it's also swords, but
Yeah.
it's there and it's out there waiting for you.
Do you have any like really memorable moments from your shot put and discus events that stand out for you? Because those are, as our listeners just heard from me a little bit ago, some of the original Olympic events. They go back ages and ages. So tell us one of your Olympic worthy stories.
Yeah, I mean, I think my favorite Olympic story is that I was lucky enough that because of my height and because of my strength, I have just kind of, and I think a lot of that comes from being, the daughter of giants and whatnot,
Well.
but I have a slight advantage. And it was once I found throwing as a sport was something that I could do, I just fell in love with it, and I was able to go very far very quickly. I, within the first season of doing it, not only made it to varsity, but also went directly to the meet of champions in the state of New Jersey. So I had like placed well enough in enough competitions with absolutely minimal training that I just ended up somewhere where I was like, I have no right to be here, and then spent the rest of my time in the sport trying to make up for my sheer luck in the beginning and actually like learning the technique and getting to meet all of these like wonderful, powerful throwers and get to train with them and be a part of their world for a while, which was nice.
That's really great. It sounds seems like you just fell into something that you were meant to be there. That was something you didn't even know that you were supposed to be doing. So that guy who told you he'd break your legs, which sounds like maybe a son of Ares himself, an unacknowledged son of Ares or something.
Absolutely,
His
absolutely.
heart seems to have been in the right place and he had good instincts.
Listen, he knew what he was doing. He saw from the other side of, I mean, I guess it's like that with training at camp though too. You see some kids and you see the way they hold the sword and they're gonna do a great job. You see some people and that they're gonna be great singers. You know that they're gonna do all this stuff. It's part of the assumptions that are good, right? That you're like, I see what you're doing, and I see something that you could really shine at if you would just give it a chance. Because before him, I never would have given it a chance. I was like, track and field, nah. But then it became my favorite thing in the world for a very long time.
That's fantastic. So, to finish up, how about some Olympic stories from camp? Do you have any great Olympic moments from this past summer or favorite Olympic events that you just loved to participate with the kids, watch the campers do?
I mean, building nymph houses is always going to have a special place in my heart. We did that as an Olympic event at camp a couple times, which I thought was great. But I talked a little bit about sword fighting earlier. I got the honor. I was honored to be able to kind of lead some of those basic sword training exercises throughout the week because of the work that I do at the Renaissance Fair and how I am a stage combatant. So I was teaching sword skills to many demigods, and I had demigods promise that they would be able to beat me by the end of the week. And I wasn't gonna let them win without putting up a good fight. But demigods are quick, and I may be long, and I might have better reach than they do. But if a demigod puts their mind to it, I got put in my place a couple times, and I think those kind of Olympic moments, ones that aren't necessarily in the Olympics at camp, but really have a demigod succeeding, are some of the most magical athletic moments I could have asked for.
And then they know they've earned it too. If you're not, letting them have it, then
Yeah.
it means so much more when they know they've earned it.
Absolutely.
Well, Anna, thank you so much for joining us today. Before I let you go, is there just anything else you want to share with our demigods about the intersection of athleticism and identity?
No, I think I hit all the points that I really wanted to talk about. I hope that everyone goes out there and finds what they love and doesn't let anyone else's perception of who they are stop them.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. Anna has a really wonderful point about how cool the human and demigod body is, and how athletics can train it to do even more amazing things. Demigods, do you know what the most popular sport in the USA is? Well, the answer is a little different if you're talking about the most popular sport to watch or the most popular sport to play. For watching, the crown goes to American football. Nearly 75% of Americans say they watch football, and NFL games regularly get millions of viewers. The 2023 Super Bowl game was watched by 113 million people. That's about a third of the entire country. Although, Aunt Euterpe does have a point. Some of us might have been tuning in as much for the halftime show as for the actual sports. But music and sports have had a long, close relationship, so that's not too surprising either, really. Football just wouldn't feel the same without the marching band, and the ancient games often had feats of music and dance accompanying them. Demigods, what sports or athletic activities do you like to play or watch? One survey identified basketball, baseball, soccer, football, and gymnastics as the most popular sports for kids between the ages of 6 and 18. Is your favorite on that list? Or do you do something a little more offbeat, like field hockey, lacrosse, swim team, or ice skating? Have you gotten interested in an ancient sport like track and field or archery because of your demigod background? If you've ever created some artwork about participating in or watching a sport, we'd love to see it. You can use the link in the show notes with Immortal Guardians' help and permission to share it with us. Well, demigods, that wraps it up for this episode. Since the next episode will come out right before Halloween, we'll be taking a look at some of mythology's spookiest figures. That episode will be the last for season one of Myths and Muses. Make sure you're subscribed to the podcast now so that you'll be alerted when new episodes come out in 2024. Until next time, thanks for listening. Myths and Muses is brought to you by Mythic Camps, a division of Plato Learning. Since 2010, Plato Learning has remained steadfast in our quest to turn stories over to the imaginations of young people who infuse them with energy, power, and ingenuity, reminding us all how and why we fall in love with reading and storytelling. To learn more about our summer camps, Camp Half-Blood, Camp Jupiter, Daring Girls, and Camp Mythic, please visit mythiccamps.com. That's Mythic with a K, mythiccamps.com, or find us on Facebook and Instagram. Until next time, demigods, stay brave out there.